calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Kevin McCullough is on the line with us. He has a new book coming out. It's called Musclehead Revolution, Overturning Liberalism with Common Sense Thinking. The first American to call himself a liberal, Kevin, in my recollection, was, at least after the United States was the United States, was President George Washington, who proudly attached that label to himself. And in reading through your book, it seems to me that you create a series of straw men so you can knock them down. I'm wondering, what is it about the liberal ideals on which this country was founded that you find so offensive?
Well, the liberal ideals that the country were founded upon probably aren't the same liberal ideals that liberals embrace today.
I would strongly disagree with that.
I think I know that you would, Tom. By the way, thanks for having me on. You're the first liberal show that has invited me, so I'm appreciative of that, and I'm going to make recognition of that on my own show in New York this afternoon. Now, you understand if you've read through the book how I define the primary difference between conservatives and liberals, and you might not like it. There might be others that don't like it, but I think I can make a pretty good case for it. Conservatives believe that there is a God. Liberals believe that they are God. And
no,
that
come
fundamental
on.
Difference
that is demagoguery, right? Kevin.
How is that demagoguery?
Because, first of all, you're portraying all liberals as having any particular religious belief. I know liberals who are Catholics. I know liberals who are fundamentalist Christians. I myself am a Christian. I know liberals who are Jews.
How would you define your Christianity? What makes you a Christian?
This isn't about me and my Christianity,
no,
Kevin.
This is about saying that
all liberals believe that they are greater than God. And I'm sorry, it's
that's
simply
not
true.
Try to stay specific to what I said. I said that by and large, in general, conservatives believe there is a God, that by and large, general liberals believe that they are God. That's the difference.
So you would say Osama bin Laden, for example, is a conservative?
Well, I hear him being referred to as a conservative all the time by people on your side of the debate.
Well, he believes there's a God.
As do, 95% of all Muslims, Jews, Protestants, Catholics that are in America.
And you would say that, for example, Abraham Lincoln, who refused to identify himself as a Christian, that he was a liberal.
He did not refuse. One of the greatest quotes he was quoted for was saying that he wasn't so much concerned that God was on his side, but that we were on God's.
He was speaking rhetorically. You read his writings about religion; it's very clear that Lincoln had basically no use for religion.
Why is it that my friends on the left have such a difficult time with that statement? The statement that I and that's really
because,
one of the premises of the book.
Because it's the same thing as my saying to you, Kevin. Kevin, have you stopped beating your wife yet?
It's not the same thing. Let me.
It certainly is. It assumes something that doesn't exist and then attacks people based on an assumption that in and of itself is fallacious.
Let me explain what the assumption is built upon. Conservatives believe. And if you survey most of Red America, what you guys call Jesus Land, you'll find that the average...
I don't refer to Red America as Jesus Land.
Oh, I appreciate that.
So, again, here's another one of these generalizations. I mean, the book is just filled with all these liberals, all these guys.
Well,
This is really destructive to America, Kevin McCullough.
It's not destructive to America, Tom.
The website, by the way,
is one of the most important things that we can have.
And then the website, by the way, for Kevin's book is muscleheadrevolution.com for those people who want to learn more about it. Continue.
Let me explain the difference. What I'm talking about is a viewpoint of God. So when you get up in the morning, when I get up in the morning, we all have things that we base what our worldview is built upon. A lot of the coming out of 2004, and you remember the day after, all the pundits were like, what was the weird thing that happened in Ohio and Mississippi and even your state in Oregon where marriage amendments were on the ballot and people went and voted? In your state, a lot of people voted Kerry at the top of the ticket, and they voted in favor of the non-redefinition of marriage further down on the ticket. What caused that kind of moral values turnout that we saw in 2004? It's real simple. There are common sense, everyday people that are living their lives that have some sort of faith understanding, and that faith understanding informs them of how they live their life. It says we live according to a set of moral absolutes, a set of rules, laws, biblical values, whatever you want to call it, that we feel like are personally important. As they go through their life, they try as best they can to adhere to those. Now, they may be evangelicals, they may be Protestants, they may be Catholics, they may be Jews, they may be Buddhists, Muslims, whatever you want to put it in there. That's the context. But they fundamentally view that those rules, laws, absolutes, that their God, whatever he may look like, has informed them of, that they are subject to them. I would say that, and amongst many of my New York liberal friends, I will speak to them specifically, about them specifically, that there is a view that there is no absolute truth. There's nothing that we can know for sure to be an absolute law or an absolute rule or something that has absolute morality to it. Now, how you view whether or not absolutes exist is going to change everything else about what you see, how you're going to interpret world events from that point on. And if liberals, by definition, are people that kind of defy limits, boundaries, they want to be more than or beyond than or whatever, then they're going to feel restricted by saying God says we have to adhere to a certain set of standards. They're going to naturally not feel like that's what being liberal is, because it kind of goes against the definition of what they think liberalism is.
Where do you find that in the writings of Rousseau and Locke and Jefferson and Washington, the classic liberals who defined liberalism?
I find it in the writings of the New York Times and the ACLU and how people are living their lives today. Like I said, I started the interview by answering your question. I don't think that what was liberal to George Washington is what is liberal to liberals today.
Oh, I think it very much is, and it's very, very clear.
Let me at least trying to explain where.
Sure. So if your first definition is that in your mind, conservative means religious of a particular type, believing in a particular type of religion in a particular way, and
no. Because I just made this, I made the case
okay.
that
in the book
it transcends all types of religious views. But the view is that there is an outside authority that has informed us to live by absolutes.
Got it. We've got the absolute authority who said we have to live by absolutes. Jesus never discussed gay marriage, ever. It's not in the New Testament. I've read the book four times, cover to cover. It's not there. However, in the Old Testament, in both Deuteronomy and Leviticus, you will find specific condemnations of homosexuality. In those books, you will also find that if your child speaks ill of you, you are to put him to death. That if a person wears clothing made of two kinds of fabric, they should be put to death. That if a person eats shellfish, they should be shunned by the community. If they repeat, they should be put to death. Why are you not following those absolutes if you're such an absolutist?
Did you find anything in the New Testament where Jesus said that the laws of the Old Testament were actually invalid?
Actually, he said, "I have come to fulfill the law,"
which means
not to destroy it.
Right. So what is not to destroy it? That's interesting. So how does he fulfill the law?
But the point, and I don't want to get into a theological debate here with you, Kevin McCullough. What you're saying is that conservatives follow the tenets of religion, and what I'm saying is that's a nonsensical argument, because the tenets of religion are the true tenets of biblical religion are inconsistent with most conservative positions.
And that's why I disagree.
Jesus said, love your enemy and don't kill people.
Church-going people across America, you will find that the majority of faith-practicing people, Tom, vote far more conservatively than those who don't practice a faith of any sort, or those who practice their faith with very little respect for the values and traditions of their faith.
I would strongly disagree. I would say instead, a better way of saying that, Kevin McCullough, and this is probably something we can agree on, is that those people who attend church, who are high on religiosity, which may or may not represent faith, are more likely to vote Republican and to be lockstep on pretty much anything else they're told to do, then are those people who vote Democratic or
so. Do you believe that churchgoers are just sitting there expecting to be told by their pastor who they're supposed to vote for, and then they go out and vote for them?
No, speaking as one myself, I don't. No. And we have less than a minute left. Let's talk about some of the economic issues in
sure.
the book, Kevin. You view liberalism as a terrible thing economically for the United States. You think, for example, that a flat tax is the only fair tax. And yet a flat tax means that the very wealthy pay a very small percentage of what they need to live on in taxes, and the average working guy is paying all of his taxes on what he has to live on.
How is it more or less fair for all people to pay the same percentage across the board? If I make $9,000 a year, that means I'm going to pay $90 in taxes. If I make $9 million a year, it means I'm going to pay $90,000 in taxes.
If you're making $9 million a year, you're using proportionately much greater than that 10%, for example,
I'm
of
also
the commons.
Employing a lot of people, Tom. I'm putting a lot of people to work.
That's a whole separate issue.
It is.
Yeah. Well, we're out of time. Kevin McCullough, the book.
Thanks for the fun time. I appreciate
sure.
it.
Sure. Muscleheadrevolution.com is the website. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Helping you win the water cooler wars. Tom Hartman here with you on Common Sense from the Radical Middle. Kevin McCullough, MuscleheadRevolution.com is his website. Musclehead Revolution, his book. I asked Kevin to stick around for another segment here because I really felt that we didn't do justice to this the second step of our discussion, and that it's one that's worth continuing for at least a few more minutes. Kevin, you still there?
I am, Tom. Thanks for keeping me around.
Sure. You had asked why is a flat tax unfair? And why historically have we not had flat taxes? Why have we had progressive taxation? Thomas Jefferson wrote about this back in 17, would have been in this, around the time of the Constitution, would have been 1787, 1788. And he suggested that the United States was not founded on a landed gentry, and that we should never have a landed gentry in the United States, that the ability to accumulate wealth to the point where it could threaten the existence of a state of, by, and for the people is something that should be prevented. And in that, he argued in favor of a progressive tax. He also suggested that there should be no tax on what he called the first wants. In other words, a person should pay no tax on what basic survival stuff, housing, food, things like that. And so that was the first progressive tax proposal put forward by Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Paine expanded on it considerably in his book, Rights of Man. And so that's the first reason for a progressive tax. Secondly, with a flat tax, you've got people at the bottom end of the economic ladder. Not only are they paying their $9 on their $90 in income, but they're also paying sales tax on everything that they buy, and they are buying, they're using all of their money to buy things, whereas if I'm making $1 million, I'm not using all that money to buy things. I'm investing it, and I'm not paying any tax when I'm doing that. Number one, we don't want to stop a landed gentry. Yeah, well, that's two good starting points there for you. Go at it.
Well, the interesting thing about what you brought up is that Jefferson makes this argument for the welfare of the state, so that you can't accumulate wealth.
No, not for the welfare of the state, for the existence of democracy. His concern was they had just overthrown a country that was basically run by about 40 wealthy families and had been for the better part of 300 years. And he didn't want to see that ever happen again in the United States.
And see, as intellectual as that explanation is, I think it still disconnects, Tom, from the average man and woman working in America today, a family making $50,000 that is having a hard time paying their tax bill because they're seen as being in some way doing very, very well when $50,000 a year doesn't go that far. Trust me.
But your flat tax is going to raise taxes on people who are making $50,000 a year.
No, actually, a 10% flat tax across the board would not. There's no one paying. The only group that's not paying 10% federally are the bottom third that aren't paying anything. So if they're
not paying any income tax. Right now we have a situation where on the first $90,000 of income, only people who are making $90,000 and less are paying FICA. 100% of their income is being taxed for FICA, Medicare, Social Security, all those kind of things. If you make your living sitting on your butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive, your maximum income tax rate is 15% right now, period. I mean, much lower than anybody else.
Your federal income tax rate?
Yeah.
It's not 15%.
It's
in the low 30s. Where are you getting that number from?
That was the major proposal. That was the major reform that George Bush did 2 years ago in the tax code. And I can tell you, because I have dividend income. If you have
dividends, 15%. But on federal income tax, the federal income tax rate is still in the low 30s.
If your income comes from dividends, if you make your living sitting on your butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive, in other words, if you're a true capitalist, And I'll put my hand up and say I'm one of them.
And your money is working for you.
Then right, and rather than working by the sweat of your brow or of your hand, then the maximum tax you pay in the United States under these conservatives is 15% because the conservative ideal was there's really two different kinds of people, two different kinds of labor. There's the privileged conservative elite who should get their hands dirty, no, and they pay maximum 15% tax, and everybody else pays the 30% rate.
No, well, I would argue that the number of people that are actually able to live off the dividend income is extremely small. And I think when you go to average America, you go to mom and Joe Pop America, where they are going to work every day and they are paying taxes, and they're saying there is something wrong about the fact that if I move up from the $50,000 a year to the $75,000 a year, that now I have to pay even more in taxes, and heaven forbid I break the $100,000 a year barrier, I'm considered wealthy. When if you live in northern New Jersey, New York City, the Connecticut area where I broadcast to, you can't even buy a home for under about $500,000.
Kevin, you and I absolutely agree that the tax rate is right now a mess and it should be simplified, and certainly those things should be raised. But what we're really talking about are people who are making $2 million, $5 million, $10 million. The number two health insurance company in the United States just made $1.5 billion last year.
How many people do wealthy individuals employ? How many jobs are created in the economy because someone
zero.
Come up with an idea?
Zero. Zero. They do
not
create jobs. Jobs are created by demand. read Adam Smith. Kevin McCullough, MuscleheadRevolution.com.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
I got news of the very best kind about troubles that have fallen behind about people that used to be blind till they open up their eyes to see. It's news when they begin to ask why they're poor until the day that they die they're tired of buying a sky and they want some security. And that's news, ain't that news, ain't that something to see. News, you talk about the news, it's mighty good news to me.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back to our program, Truth in Broadcasting for a Change in America. This is one of the most pernicious, the one that our last guest, Kevin, started off with. And one of the things that I just don't do on this program is beat up on people when they're not around. So I'll, some other day, Kevin and I will have this debate as Kevin and I. But just, the meme, I'm certainly going to go off after this. This whole idea, back from the founding of this country, until Ronald Reagan declared war on working people in 1981, when 25 years ago, last week, he busted the PATCO union and began and converting the Department of Labor from an agency that advocated the interests of labor to an agency that was working against the interests of labor. For most of the history of the United States, people understood that, as Abraham Lincoln said, labor is superior to capital because labor precedes capital. In other words, you don't have anything until you make something. And for the vast majority of the history of the United States, people understood. And let me just qualify this by saying I'm saying this as a former businessman myself. I mean, yeah, I started out in radio back in the 60s. I did radio. I was a DJ. I did news for 7 years. I was a program director. I spent 10 years in the business in the 70s. Got out of it. I've been back now. This is the fourth year of doing progressive talk radio. And in the interim, I did a number of things, including starting 7 businesses that employed in total several hundred people over the years and you know, made a pretty good living for myself. No complaints. And what's absolutely real to me in looking back on that, and for that matter, this radio show is a business. I mean, I write books. That's a business. We have a corporation. We run all that stuff through. What's absolutely clear to me is that I never created a job in my life, even though I hired hundreds of people over the course of my career. Because it was the demand in the marketplace that created those jobs. And this and the people who worked for me, I wasn't giving them a job. I was hoping that I could make more money off their labor than I had to pay for it. I mean, David Poole, my producer, he's sitting here next to me. Nod. And my goal as an employer has to be that the value that I get out of David's work, in other words, David helping put together this program every day, being here at 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, and it's much appreciated, David, that the work that David does has to produce more money than what David costs. Because if it doesn't, we don't have a business. And if we don't have a business, you know, nobody makes a living. So the bottom line is everybody always understood in the United States that jobs were created by demand in the marketplace and that the producers in a business were not the CEOs. The producers were the people who did the work. Now, I would argue on this radio show, I'm doing some of the work, too. But that's, we could say Louise is the boss, right? Louise does even more work than David and I. In any case, we don't have any CEOs here. But the point is that we always understood this. In fact, we used to refer to labor as producers. For the first 200 years of American history, people, workers, were referred to as producers. There were producers and there were capitalists. Those who produce things and those who make their money by investing their money. And I'm not trashing capitalists. I'm saying, I own 2.5 shares of Marriott stock. I get my 17-cent check every 3 months. It's those of you who have been listening a long time following that saga. But the point is that, well, I own a little other stock than that. But the point is that this whole notion that if we just give rich people money, they will then create jobs. Like jobs are a beneficence, or however you say it, that they're some sort of, here, let us aristocratic conservative elite give you poor working masses a job. I mean, Bush carried this so far, and this is what boggles my mind, is that people bought it. People so bought it that not one voice in the media was raised in opposition to it. Now, that could be because if you turn on your television, the vast majority of people you see on TV are making, high six-figure, seven-figure salaries. So they are the rich. So they're not going to point out things that might hurt the middle class and help the rich. But here's George Bush saying, if we give wealthy people in the United States $500,000 each, if you give them $500,000 tax cut, they'll create one job. I kid you not. $550 billion divided by 1 million is $550,000 per job. Just do the math in your head as you listen to George W. Bush.
With a robust package of at least $550 billion and across the board tax relief, we will help create more than 1 million new jobs.
1 million jobs, $550 billion in tax breaks. So we give $550,000 per job in tax breaks. And then they wonder why it doesn't work. Well, the fact of the matter is that those huge tax breaks did produce jobs. A lot of very wealthy people got huge tax breaks and said, hey, I got an extra $20 million in my pocket this year. What'll I do with it? Well, I think I'll build a factory, create some jobs in China, in Mexico, in India. Did it create any jobs here? Not of any consequence. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Gary in Glen Island, Nebraska. Hey, Gary, welcome to the program.
Thank you for your program, Tom.
Sure.
You know, I tell you, sitting quietly and listening to this gentleman that you had as the last guest is very difficult to do. Growing up in a very conservative religious home, as I became about 55, my life fell apart. I started reading the Bible myself, which before was hard to do because I had a hard time reading. But in the last 5 years, I've read it through about 7 or 8 times, and I've seen a different. I've changed, and I've now become a liberal.
Well, Jesus was the original liberal.
And it means my day, I start my day off with an hour, half hour to an hour of worship each morning alone by myself. And it becomes very repulsive to me to have some arrogant person like that think that I believe God is myself. When he just doesn't understand what he's talking about. But I had a question for him, but to illustrate one of the fallacies of his argument, you know, when Jesus was watching the widow put in her 2 coins, he commented how she had given much more than the others who had given huge amounts, some of them.
Right.
And the disciples looked at him like he had lost his mind, and how can that be? She gave all that she could give in comparison to the huge amount. That is an implied affirmation of the concept of a progressive tax, if
You're
I
right.
ever thought of one.
You're right. Gary, brilliant point. Brilliant point. Thank you very much for calling
Thank
and sharing
you.
It. I appreciate it. Tom in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hey, Tom, welcome to the program.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah, this, you know, this irreligious, the irreligious liberal straw man, is, we all know, is a diversion just to get the working class FDR liberals to vote for the con, cheap labor, real agenda, right? And I just cannot believe that they still get mileage from this tired dribble.
They don't just get mileage from it. I mean, this guy's book is being endorsed by Laura Schlesinger, and
yeah.
I mean, he's just having just the whole crowd. You know?
Yeah. See, we only can talk in sound bites. I mean, that's where we have degenerated into a sound bite culture. So when they come back with this stuff, like you guys are irreligious, I just throw out President Carter, Reverend Martin Luther King, Jesse Jackson, blah, blah, blah. Then I go to, because we know that's a cultural wedge issue. Then immediately I talk about the Republican Great Depression and Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, because that's what they're about, unraveling New Deal. Why don't liberals just talk about that on television?
Yeah, well, the conservatives are pretty straightforward about it. Here's Rush Limbaugh.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Yeah, the New Deal, the whole thing, you know, Social Security, it's socialism. Unemployment insurance, that's socialism. Medical health care, that's socialism. We got to undo all of this stuff.
But why don't, I mean, I'm just...
Progressive taxation, it's socialism.
Why are liberals afraid to invoke the greatest president of the 20th century and use it as a cudgel and let these guys try to attack FDR? Why don't we do that?
Well, first, I'd suspect, Tom, because probably most people who are under 40 years old, under 50 for that matter, have no recollection of Franklin Roosevelt.
But there are thousands alive. Alex
we don't.
In California that
oh, I understand that, but we're, the simple fact of the matter is in the 1980s, the Reagan conservatives went on an absolute jihad against the teaching of civics in our schools. They said that there were liberal teachers in the schools, and they were teaching liberal doctrine. And what it was the history of the United States. And schools and teachers and textbooks got so spooked and got so politically correct that we no longer teach in this country the true history of this country. We no longer teach about the Enlightenment. We no longer teach about Rousseau and Locke. We don't know the people who inspired Jefferson. We no longer teach about the Iroquois Confederacy. We no you know, those of I don't know how old you are, Tom, but you know, those of us who are old
in
farts,
40.
You know, yeah, I'm in my 50s, and I remember back when they taught that stuff in school, and we have some grounding for it, but and we learned who Franklin Roosevelt was, but they don't do it anymore.
Last night on C-SPAN Book TV, the guy who just wrote that book, what's his name? Talking Right. He talks about Roosevelt talking about freedom, economic freedom versus their phony freedom about the individualism, Ayn Rand, and all that. That book, Talking Right, he was talking about that.
Yeah. Tom, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program.
We're wussies for war, wussies for war. We don't even know what the war is for, but we will expedite it if somebody else will fight it, cause we're gung-ho.
We won't go wussies for war.
Ah, the old Chicken Hawk song. Yes, indeed. George, he went AWOL. Dick, he didn't serve. Karl Rove, no, he didn't serve. Rush Limbaugh, well, he had a pimple on his butt. I'm sorry. What can you say? By the way, welcome to two new affiliates, KOPT 1600 in Eugene, Oregon. Welcome to our program. This is the Tom Hartman radio program you're listening to. And WVAX 1450 AM in Charlottesville, Virginia. Very pleased to have you both on board with us and honored, in fact, to be on your radio programs and in your cities. Tom, our last caller mentioned Roosevelt. I know I got a bunch more calls to get to here, and we just have a few minutes, but I just have to share this with you. Franklin Roosevelt was talking about economic royalists. This is from his July 1936 speech before the Democratic Party when he was nominated for his second term in office. And he talks about how these economic royalists have risen up and trying to take over government itself, and that we must fight back against the economic royalists, or they will turn America into a world like Charles Dickens wrote about in The Christmas Carol, where you've got Scrooge and Marley, Mr. Scrooge, Bob Marley, or Bob Cratchit, rather. Mr. Scrooge, may I please have a lump of coal? My hands are getting cold.
No, you can't have a lump of coal. Are you kidding? It'll cost me a pence. It'll come out of my profits here. No,
well, how about health care for my son, Tim?
No, you can't have it.
And that's the world that they want to take us back to. And Roosevelt said no.
These economic royalists complain that we seek to overthrow the institutions of America.
And they were. They were calling Roosevelt a traitor. They were calling him a communist. They were calling him every name in the book.
What they really complain of is that we seek to take away their power. Our allegiance.
And it's the same with modern conservatives, by the way.
And our allegiance to American institutions requires the overthrow of this kind of power.
Requires the overthrow of this kind of power. You get it? How long has it been since a politician talked like that? Well, John Edwards talks a bit like that. Here's Roosevelt just wrapping this thing up. Franklin Roosevelt.
In vain, they seek to hide behind the flag and the Constitution.
This is starting to sound like deja vu all over again. This is an old playbook, I'm telling you.
But in their blindness, they forget what the flag and the Constitution stand for.
And then he talks about freedom from the overprivileged alike, from control.
Now, as always, for over a century and a half, the flag, the Constitution, stand against a dictatorship by mob rule and the overprivileged alike. And the flag and the Constitution stand for democracy, not tyranny, for freedom, not subjection.
And one of the points that he made also in that speech was, you know, he says, a necessitous man is not a free man. In other words, if you're hungry, you're not free. I'm sorry. You know, the cons would say, oh, we're all free. I'm sorry. If you're hungry, you're not free. It's just that simple. Patricia in Sacramento, California, listening on KSAC. Hey, Patricia, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. I want to wrap this up quickly because I have two little toddlers here. But in regards to your last guest, you know, when he was talking about invoking God and how conservatives are so godlike, why don't we examine their voting records and see what exactly how they vote relates to what Jesus preached? For example,
oh, yeah, they should go back and read Matthew 25, you know, the Great Commission. I mean, you know.
I mean, just a few to name, you know, allowing oil companies to make record profits while putting such a great burden on the middle class and the poor, having to pay such high prices.
Yeah.
You give tax breaks to corporations that move jobs overseas, so we're losing jobs. You have minimum wage. They won't increase the minimum wage, but yet Congress will increase their wages every year, even
yeah.
though they're making over $100,000 a year, but their wages get increased with the cost of living, yet minimum wage earners do not get an increase. I mean, it just goes on and on. I mean, VA cuts, they're talking about estate tax relief while you have cuts in the VA.
I know.
I mean,
these are phony. These are the Christians that Jesus complained about, the folks, you know, in the temple. And when he talked about in Matthew 7 in the Sermon on the Mount, he talks about the fellow who stands on the prayer on the corner praying, you know, because people will see all his Patricia, I guess the kids got a little loud on you there. You know, all the people will see his or hear his prayers and think, you know, he says, go pray in your closet, do your good works in private, and anyway, a whole other rant. Jason in Grand Rapids, Michigan, WTKG.
Yes, hey, Jason, thank you for taking my call. First of all, while we're on the subject of treason, Franklin Roosevelt was not the one that was committing treason. I think that was reserved for George W. Bush's grandfather, Prescott Bush. And if people want to know more about that, they should Google Prescott Bush and Hitler together.
Right. Prescott Bush was supplying Hitler during the war, and Franklin Roosevelt outed him on it and earned the eternal hatred of the Bush family.
I almost fell out of my chair when I started reading some of that stuff. Just out of curiosity, I just kind of ran across that. But anyway, this is in reference to your guest a little earlier.
Right. We have just a few seconds left, Jason.
Okay. He basically is viewing things from a skewer perspective. I mean, we people in the real world are the ones that are suffering. If you're making all that money, you have no connection to the people at this level. And at one time during the 90s, I was, like, working three jobs, but that was at my discretion. Now I'm struggling just with the one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not nearly enough.
Yeah.
Not at all.
So the conservatives in your mind are playing fast and loose with the numbers?
Right. And I'm not sure where the economy is good, but it's not here.
Yeah. Okay. Good on you. Thank you. Thank you very much, Jason. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news. Coming up, Peter Wallstein, his book, One Party Country, The Republican Plan for Dominance in the 21st Century. You don't think that's a little scary? Mike Huckleberry is going to be with us as well, Taking Back My Country. He's running for Congress in Michigan's 4th District. Lots coming up. We'll be back after the news. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And every time Rush Limbaugh hears that theme music, he ups his meds. Welcome back, my friends. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466, 440-THOM. If you want to drop into our live chat room, tomhartman.com, however you spell it, will get you there. Just click live chat. If you want to participate in our blog or message board, you can click on that as well. At the moment, we have right now with us Peter Walston. He's the co-author of a new book, One Party Country, The Republican Plan for Dominance in the 21st Century. Co-authored with Tom Hamburg. Peter Walston writes for the Los Angeles Times. Peter, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. I'm really glad to be here, and I apologize about all the noise in the background. I'm in the talking to you from the press filing center in Crawford, Texas, where I'm covering the president. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, before we go any farther, what's happening in Crawford?
Well, it's, let's see, the usual slow summer. Cindy Sheehan and her supporters are here protesting the war. She's hoping for a meeting with the president. And this morning, actually, the president and Condi Rice had a press conference where they talked a little bit about their hope for the UN resolutions and some sort of resolution in the Middle East.
Yeah, and George is still on vacation.
Well, he was wearing a coat and tie this morning, so they at least want us to have the impression that he's hard at work.
Yeah. Well, I think the vacation thing just didn't go over all that well this year. You know, it was sort of like people look back on that August in 2001 when he was on vacation and he got that briefing that said, you know, Bin Laden determined a strike in the United States, and he said, I think I'll go clear some brush, you know. So it just didn't go over well.
And last year's vacation didn't go so well either. That was also the Iraq War protests dominated the news until Katrina hit.
Right. So this year he's only going to spend 10 days down there. He's going to spend the rest of his vacation in at Camp David and at his family compound in Kennebunkport to avoid Cindy Sheehan, apparently. Anyhow, we're talking with Peter Walston. He's the co-author of this new book, One Party Country, The Republican Plan for Dominance in the 21st Century. Peter, this, from looking over your book, it seems that what you're suggesting is that the Republicans are engaged in something very different from traditional partisan politics, where historically the parties have said, you know, here's what we're all about, here's what we believe, we're going to communicate our message well, we're going to get the American people behind us, they're going to vote us into power, they're going to keep us in office because they like what we're doing. The modern-day Republicans that I'm reading about in your book, that's considered naive. That's the old-school stuff.
Tom, I think you've gotten it exactly right. The Republicans have figured out how to harness all of this new technology. Kind of the backbone of this whole plan is a massive voter database where they have amassed all sorts of marketing information. They've purchased it. It's very expensive data from retailers, magazine publishers, et cetera. So they really can identify voters. And you're right. Politics is changed now. At least the Republicans have changed it so that no longer do you just air a bunch of television ads and put your message out and allow the voters to choose which candidate they want to vote for. Now it's the politicians have big campaigns that figure out where the voters are, so the politicians choose their voters rather than the other way around.
Right. You write this almost as if the Republican Party has become a multinational corporation, certainly a national corporation, in some ways a multinational corporation, actually. It's use of foreign policy, certainly, to advance its own goals.
Certainly, although, you know, this is politics is nothing new on the presidential level, whether it's foreign policy or domestic policy. What we have in this in one party country is simply the reality of today's politics, which is that the Republicans have figured this out and are simply waging politics in a more sophisticated and we argue more effective way than the Democrats.
We're talking to Peter Walston, the co-author of a new book, The One Party Country, onepartycountry.com, by the way, the website. He covers the White House national politics for the Los Angeles Times. Peter, one of the things that concerned me most or disturbed me most about your book, Benito Mussolini came up with this idea of merging corporate and state interests. His symbol was the bundle of sticks with a rope around it, the idea being that you can break one stick, you can't break a bundle of sticks. That bundle of sticks used the old Latin word, the fasce, you know, for it. And his idea of fascism was this merger of corporate and state interests so that you had the economic power of the corporations and the political and police power of the state together, and it would create a system of government that would be stable and would endure, and you wouldn't have to deal with these pesky things like democracy and what the people really want. And your book documents this merging of corporate and state interests and also of corporate and church interests in ways that, and we can get to that in just a second as well, that are truly spooky.
Well, it's a very interesting new development over the last 6 or 8 years. Now, a lot of your listeners, I'm sure, have heard about the K Street Project and work that Tom DeLay, the former House Majority Leader, did to bring corporations really to, and according to many reports, to intimidate corporations into helping Republicans and raise money for corporations.
Well, and to give credit where credit's due, it was Tom DeLay and Rick Santorum, really.
That's right, and others, Grover Norquist of Americans for Tax Reform, is also heavily involved in that.
Right.
Now, what we write about in One Party Country is that this is actually far more, elaborate than that. It also involves drawing corporations into the political fray as well, really turning corporate America into almost a branch of the Republican campaign machine in the same way that really, frankly, organized labor had been for decades for the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
They really viewed that they needed what the Republicans learned, and much of this plan, we write about how effective it is now. A lot of it, as the Republicans explained to us, they learned from the Democrats. You know, they believed that the Democrats, for years and years and years, had a far more effective grassroots machine, and a lot of that was debate was kind of on the shoulders of organized labor. And so the Republicans went out and they said, we need to have an answer to that. So their answer was corporate America. And that
but there's a fundamental difference here. Labor is the last democracy left in the workplace. In other words, people elect their labor leaders. Corporations are the last vestiges in our society of feudal systems, of kingdoms. You know, you have the CEO, you have a hierarchy, and workers don't get to vote in a corporation. In a labor union, they do get to vote. So the Democrats, historically, were relying on a democratic institution, labor unions. The Republicans are relying on many kingdoms.
Well, actually, that's a great point. And it's interesting that one area that we've seen the Republicans pick up on, though, is that the organized, even though there is now somewhat of a difference between the leaders of organized labor and the and union members, and this is one area, this is a different section of the book, but this is, you know, the Republican, part of this Republican plan is to peel away the different pieces of the Democratic constituency. So that includes, right. We can talk about Latinos and African Americans and Jews, but this also, interestingly enough, involves union workers, and especially in places like West Virginia, where they have managed to play the environmentalists against the idea of jobs.
Right, and set this thing up. We only have a minute and a half or so left here. We're talking with Peter Walston. He's the author of One Party Country, a co-author, onepartycountry.com, the website. Peter, James Madison's first veto in office back in 1812 was to veto a law that gave money to a church to care for poor people in Washington, D.C. And he did so because he agreed with Jefferson that there should be this wall of separation between government and church. Jefferson's fear was that churchmen would end up in government and turn America into a theocracy. Madison's fear, he didn't fear that. Madison's fear was that if government ever gave money to churches, churches would become corrupt and would no longer follow their religious mission and would become beholden to government. From reading your book, it seems that both of them have seen their worst fears realized.
Well, this administration believes that they've created the faith-based initiative, which I think is what you're referring to here.
Right.
The White House, a program called the White House Faith-Based Initiative.
$1 billion to churches in the 2004 election cycle.
A lot of money, and more every year, they say, is being directed to churches, and this is part of a plan. Again, it was viewed as a gift to the conservative white evangelical movement, but in fact, as we discovered in this book, it was really a way to create an entry point for Republicans into black churches.
Right.
And they managed
who were large recipients of a lot of the faith-based money early on.
Yes, and a lot of the pastors whose churches received faith-based money, several of them, as we've documented in the book, did turn around a campaign for President Bush, and they were frequent visitors to the White House and remained in constant contact.
Which is exactly what James Madison was terrified. James Madison, of course, was a Christian, and Thomas Jefferson was a deist. So you know, Jefferson was worried about the Christians. Madison was worried about corrupting Christianity. Both.
Yeah, and one interesting point, though, is that it was President Clinton who understood the power of this idea from a political standpoint, and he supported charitable choice, and his wife, now Hillary Clinton, has given speeches kind of endorsing the faith-based initiative.
So it's like, gee, it works. Let's continue to use it. Man, we've got to take this country back, Peter. Peter Walston, you've written a great book, One Party Country, The Republican Plan for Dominance in the 21st Century. You can read about it at the website, onepartycountry.com. Peter, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom. My pleasure.
And for the great work that you're doing there in the book and in the Los Angeles Times. Coming up next, an update from the belly of the beast to the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
All right, Republicans, line up for duty. Where are you going? Hey!
Kicking off. Kicking off. Kicking off. Kicking off. Kicking off. Karl Rove. He didn't serve. Dick Cheney. He didn't serve. Tom DeLay. He didn't serve. And George Bush was AWOL. Chicken
Hawks. Ah, yes, and look at what the mess they've made. 21 minutes past the hour. Welcome back, my friends, to the program where we dare to ask the questions the mainstream media are afraid of. Our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics. 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS for all things Macintosh, smalldog.com, their website. 22 minutes past the hour, and Victoria Jones, our senior wacko correspondent.
That's
I must
right.
be mispronouncing that, Victoria.
Well, you could be. On the other hand, no, you could have got it about right.
Are you in Waco, Texas?
That's right. I'm on my way to Waco, Texas. That's right.
I see.
And
okay.
Tomorrow I may actually be your Crawford, Texas correspondent.
Well, we just spoke a few minutes ago with a fellow who was in Crawford. He said that it's starting to stir up a little bit there.
Oh, what does he mean?
Well, just, you know, a lot of folks showing up and typical hoop-de-doop, you know. Nothing in particular has happened so far. Bush held a news conference with Condi.
Right, he held a news conference with Condi today, which I believe was notable, really, mostly because he showed up in a suit. And
yeah.
They made a podium, and did you see on the thing behind it saying, the Western White House, did you see that?
No.
Yes,
no.
They'd actually, rather than just having on a special seal saying the Western White House. Can they do that? Is that legal?
Reagan did it. That was he's the only other president I know of who did that.
Isn't it kind of hokey?
It was Reagan's way of saying that he's someplace other than the White House, but he's not really on vacation. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that Bush has gotten so much flack for taking more vacation days than any president in the history of the United States, and for his proudly proclaiming that he knocks off the day at 5 p.m. and he doesn't work weekends, period. And nothing stops him from doing that. And, you know, Katrina, people are drowning. What does he do? He goes out and he eats cake with John McCain, and he goes playing golf, and he's playing the guitar with a rock star. And, you know, 9/11 is on its way, and the CIA is running around with their hair on fire. They sent a special, Ron Suskind in his book, 1% Solution, amazing book, sent a special delegate, a guy from the CIA down to Crawford, Texas, to personally lay this whole thing on Bush about, you know, there's something big coming, Mr. President, there's something big coming. And what does Bush do? He says, well, you've covered your butt, you know, now I've gone back. And he goes out and he goes, you know, goes fishing. And then he goes on the longest presidential vacation in the history of American politics. And even then he was afraid to go back to Washington, D.C. He goes to Florida. So I think that he's gotten enough bad publicity out of his vacations in the past that now he's going to try and make his vacations look like they're something other than a vacation.
Well, I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah, so that's the bottom line. Congress is all gone for the week?
They're gone. They're done. They're gone for 5 weeks. Vacation. Oops. No, not vacation.
it's campaigning.
It's a recess.
Yeah.
It's a recess, which means that they're really working.
Yeah, well,
campaigning.
I was going to say, the fact of the matter is, I'm guessing most of them actually are out there in their districts working, although the way
Bob
the gerrymandering...
Bob Ney's not, though, is he?
Who? Bob Ney, no. Bob
He's
Ney
not doing much work.
Has decided that the Abramoff stuff just was too much for him, I'm guessing.
I guess apparently he has.
Yeah, I talked with Ellen about that this morning. She, of course, a good friend of Bob Ney's, and she's pointing out that the Democrats ran a bunch of ads against Bob Ney in his own district, which in her mind caused him to say, that's it, I'm throwing in the towel. And so now he's being replaced. And he, of course, was, you know, all tarred and feathered with all these with the Abramoff scandal. So he was really a fairly weak Republican in a district that has been so gerrymandered, it'll be almost impossible for a Democrat to ever get elected out of that district.
Right.
And so now Ney is going to be replaced by this young woman who's apparently, you know, all spit and polish and, you know, knows the Republican talking points and going to be very hard to defeat and it could be a real force in the House of Representatives. So the Democrats shot themselves in the foot, in Ellen's mind. Is that consistent with your evaluation?
I think it probably is. It certainly wouldn't be the first time they did it. And there's another factor which probably doesn't play into anything very much, which is that Bob Ney's rather a nice man.
Mm.
Doesn't play into anything, but
yeah.
just worth mentioning.
Yeah, well, and that's the comment that Ellen makes, and you know, I don't know the guy, I've never met him, so I can't comment on that. But the any Republican from Ohio, I have a problem with. I'm
Understood.
Sorry.
Yes.
You know, part of the machine. I've got a problem with it. So we have about 30 seconds left here before we have to wrap this up, Victoria. What do you see happening on the political horizon here in the next 24 hours?
I see Bush laying a little bit lower now, Condi heading off to try and save the world with the resolutions, and I see the resolutions coming to a bit of a grinding halt.
The United Nations resolutions.
Yeah, the United Nations resolutions. There's going to be difficulties trying to resolve some of the difficulties.
Because they don't call for a withdrawal of the Israeli forces.
Right, they don't call for a withdrawal of the Israeli forces. Lebanon isn't going to agree.
They've already rejected it.
They've already rejected it, and without them, it can't move forward.
Yeah, it's a tough one. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, the website in Washington, D.C. Victoria, on her way to Waco. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks very much.
Great talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour after the break, we'll be taking our country back with Mike Huckleberry, congressional candidate in Michigan's 4th District. Let's find out where he stands on issues that are important to you.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Hey, I'm taking my country car. Son, you ain't been doing her right. I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my stars and stripes. Got too many fancy friends for me. The Saudis treat you like your royalty. You blew the budget and you bossed Iran. Now I'm taking my country back. Now I can understand why you were hot, 'cause Bin Laden never did get caught. So you said we had Saddam to blame, tried to tell us it was all the same. Now the years roll by and our kids keep dying. You don't even have a plan to bring them home. Those WMD you promised on TV, admit it. You figured it wrong, so I'm taking...
So we're taking our country back, my friends. Welcome back. Tom Hartman with you, 35 minutes past the hour. Back 6-8 months ago or so, we asked Congressman Bernie Sanders on the program, a caller called in, actually, and said, Bernie, I've got, you know, $50 in my pocket here, and I don't know what to do. I mean, should I send it to the party? Should I send it to the DCCC? What should I do? You know, the person was in a district where their representative was probably not going to have a problem. And Bernie said, it's very simple. He said, find candidates all across the United States, not necessarily in your district, who you think are worthy of your support, and send them that $25 or $50 or whatever you can afford. Or if you're in their district, get active for them. Go door to door for them. Put out a street sign. Get involved. And so ever since then, at least once a week, we've been putting on a progressive candidate, somebody who's running for office that we personally, David Poole, our producer, and Louise, check him out and say, you know, this person has some pretty good policies. This person has a chance. This person is running for office and would represent all of us well. And keep in mind that while members of Congress represent their own districts, they also represent all of us. Our taking our country back candidate today, Mike Huckleberry. He's running for Congress in the 4th District of Michigan, which is currently being represented by the Republican Dave Camp. And Mike Huckleberry's website, Huck06.com is the website, and this is in part the district. A good chunk of your district is actually reached by one of our affiliate radio stations, WTKG in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Mike, I believe. Mike Huckleberry.
Yes, sir.
Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me on.
So let's just get right into it here. Why should people in Michigan's 4th district, Mike Huckleberry, vote for you instead of Dave Camp?
Well, I'm a small restaurant owner. I own two small businesses in Greenville, Michigan. We had 3,500 jobs exported, outsourced to Mexico for what I call starvation wages and an opportunity to exploit poor, uneducated people.
That was the appliance manufacturer there, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was an Electrolux. They made refrigerators.
Electrolux, right, yeah.
Yep. My opponent has voted for 16 of these job outsourcing agreements, and his website once said, these trade agreements are good for America, good for Michigan, and offer great opportunity. Well, Mr. Hartman, when you sat here and watched, first you lose a manufacturing person, then as a small business owner, I was very well aware you lose the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker.
Yeah.
People have to have jobs in America. sending jobs to foreign countries, and especially communist China, is un-American.
Yep. Amen. Amen.
Yeah.
So what would you do about that, Mike Huckleberry, if you were elected to represent Michigan's 4th District in the United States Congress?
Well, the first thing I do is I quit voting for these. A lot of people aren't aware that they continue to vote for them. Just 2 weeks ago, they passed one called the Oman Free Trade Agreement, and last year they passed CAFTA. They have an Indian trade agreement they want to put out there. I would stop all the foreign trade agreements before we get the ones that we've got correct. And the way we correct them, every one of these.
We're talking with Mike Huckleberry. His website is huck06.com. And, Mike, if you're moving around on that cell phone, you need to stop because you're fading in and out. We're losing you.
I'm sorry.
Mike Huckleberry, huck06.com. So clearly you're not one of these Earth is Flat free trader guys. What about our school system?
What about what?
What about our school system? What would you do about our schools?
Well, my statement on school system is that I'd never underfund our future. The $12 billion cut that my opponent and the president administration made is ridiculous. They tell us that the way to compete in a global economy is through education, and then they cut funding to educate our people. The young students going to college just had a huge increase in their interest rates to go to college. They're making it unaffordable for the average person. This is wrong.
Yeah. Mike Huckleberry, he's running for the 4th District in Michigan. His website, huck06.com. Wherever you live in the United States, worth checking out. Mike Huckleberry, prescription drugs, Medicare, medical marijuana, what's your take on these issues?
I would vote in a heartbeat for medicinal marijuana. There's no question about that. I also would have voted for stem cell research. It's appalling that people would suffer in our nation because of a few people that just don't understand that suffering is wrong, and so I'm very supportive of that. It's incredibly wrong in America that we pay 300% more for our medicine than any country in the world. And the only reason that happens is these pharmaceutical companies give this bought and paid for Congress money, and they give them a lot of money. And it's not to vote for you and I and our families; it's to vote for them.
Yeah, yeah. Well said. So how do we reverse the slide that we've been in ever since 1981 when Ronald Reagan declared war on organized labor?
Isn't that incredible? Yes. The way we do it, we have to get Democrats back in there, and we have to support the union movement. There's a reason we have a union out there, and there's a thing called corporate patriotism. These corporations know exactly what they're doing to us, and there's going to come a point where they're devouring themselves. But their theory is we'll pass it on to the next generation of CEOs. Well, they're raking in all these millions of dollars in bonuses. But we still have to have a consumer to buy the product. And that consumer has to be the American worker.
Yeah, and the American worker has to have a decent enough wage that he can afford to buy products, which creates demand for more products, which creates demand for small businesses to make products, which creates more jobs, which creates more workers. And we were in a positive spiral, basically, from the time Roosevelt took control of the economy until Reagan did. And we've been in a negative spiral ever since Reagan, with his voodoo economics, started to run things.
Oh, you're absolutely right. Roosevelt's one of my favorite people, and yeah, we've seen what they've done when they only want to take care of the people at the top. The only people in America, Tom, should be happy about the economy we're in right now is the top 2%. The rest of us should be angry, including moderate Republicans. They're getting hurt, too. They're getting beat up by rising costs, lost sales. They can't afford their health care anymore. All these issues, and there's a trend out there of moderate Republicans that are finally connecting the dots.
Yeah, well said. We're talking with Mike Huckleberry, his website, huck06.com, H-U-C-K-06, and that's the number 06, right, Mike?
That's correct.
Yeah, huck06.com. And, Mike, just in summary here, to wrap this thing up, what can people do to help you in your race?
Well, I'm a Democrat, and Democrats don't raise as much money as Republicans. My opponent gets a ton of money from corporations that want to pollute, that want to outsource, don't believe in fair wages. We can always use an investment in our campaign. That's what we have to do. I'm in beautiful Leelanau, Michigan right now, one of the most beautiful places on earth. We travel every day. We do a lot of business to business. And I suppose that it's corporate America and the greed that's hurting us. So we obviously would always welcome an investment in our campaign. They can do that online at our website, and we'd certainly appreciate that.
Great. Huck06.com. Mike Huckleberry, thank you so much for being with us today, sir.
Thank you very much, and you keep up the good work.
America Thanks. Needs you. Thanks. You too. America needs you in Congress.
Thank you, my friend.
So, yeah, good talking with you. So, you know, get there. Get there as quickly as you can. It's something that I think is a pretty important step. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, and Allison in Mount Vernon, Washington on the line. Hey, Allison, what's on your mind today?
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to comment about the first call-in person you had that had written a book and characterizing, lumping together people. I've had that happen before.
And our conservative guest in the first hour of the program?
Yes, I am.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Characterizing liberals as being, thinking they're God rather than, you know, and I'm a Christian liberal, and it just, he's completely wrong to make those assumptions, and you were right by holding him to that. I appreciated the way you debated with him.
Thank you.
That was good.
Thank you. Step by
You're
step.
Welcome.
Step by step, we're going to wake this country back up. Allison, thank you for the call. Paula in Carbondale, Illinois, listening on WINI. Hey, Paula, what's up?
Hi, I just wanted to get a plug for Richard Whitney running for Illinois governor because he is actually specifically running on a New Deal program, which you mentioned that, you know, no one talks about anymore. He's running on a New Deal for sustainable energy and alternative transportation.
Uh-huh.
So if anyone's interested, they can go to whitneyforgov.org and they can find out all about it. And also our paper, the Southern Illinoisan, did a very good job. They gave him equal time with the Republican and the Democrat talking about their plan for job creation, where the Democrat and Republican were pretty big on corporate welfare and just tax breaks for the rich, a policy which has failed for 25 years. Richard specifically talked about no corporate welfare and no race to the bottom. So
is Richard Whitney a Green?
He's a Green, yeah.
He's a Green? Oh, good on him.
So if they could go to the southernillinoisan.com, you can see his program for jobs. And I would like to encourage candidates all over the country to borrow Richard's ideas. He's not selfish. You guys all need to do what he's doing.
There you go. Paula, thanks a lot for the call.
Okay,
great,
thanks.
Great to hear from you. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Well, or at least for a clean election. We'd settle for that. Just a clean election is really all we need. We'll be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Hey, you, would you help me to carry the stone? Open your heart, I'm coming home.
And welcome back, my friends, for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. It's the Tom Hartman radio program coming up on 9 minutes before the hour. Our phone number, toll-free across the United States, 1-866-440-8466. Brian in Manchester, New Hampshire. Hey, Brian, I was in your state yesterday. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I want to talk. One of the earlier callers was talking about the greatest president of the Democratic president of the 20th century, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and another great president he would have been, Robert Fitzgerald Kennedy, had he not been murdered as well as his brother John. It's laid out in your book, Ultimate Sacrifice, and I wanted to make a comparison between RFK and his contingency plan that you lay out in the book there very well, and George W. Bush. George W. Bush has taken such glee and such joy in waging these huge land wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, using a proxy, basically, Israel and Lebanon. He's invaded Haiti and exiled its leader, basically, Father Aristide. He wants to go into Cuba and Venezuela, et cetera. He's sent the special forces to raid Iran. But yet what happened after the JFK assassination, Tom, as you lay out, his own beloved brother has just been brutally murdered in the street, and yet with his Cuban contingency plan, Robert F. Kennedy seeks to, he has to cover it up, but also to avoid a bloody war with Cuba and many innocent people.
Well, a war with the Soviet Union, actually, is what he thought he was. Bobby Kennedy thought he was avoiding World War III. That was an incredibly tough one. And Brian, thank you for the call. I don't want to take the show off into the direction of one of my books, but it really is an extraordinary story about Bobby Kennedy. And I agree with you. Bobby Kennedy would have made one of the greatest presidents probably in the history of this country had he lived to do so. Thomas in Seattle, Washington. Hey, welcome to the program. Thanks for listening on Talk 1090 there in Seattle. What's up?
Are you talking to me?
I am. You're live.
Oh, great.
Hey, Thomas.
Yeah, this is the first time I've called you. And
I was
listening to your on the radio in my truck today. And they were talking about, this guy was talking about how liberals are not very Christianity.
Yeah, this is the new meme. I mean, Ann Coulter's out there running around, you know, with her book Godless and all this stuff. You know,
it just made me so angry to hear him say that. I've been a Christian all my life, and I'll tell you, I believe in God. I don't believe in, I'm God, help, by no means.
Yeah.
And another thing, this Bush has got this whole world so messed up that I don't think the next president even has a chance to get it straightened out.
It's going to be a big challenge for the next president.
Yeah, because
it's going to be a big challenge.
These supposed Americans that are running the show right now, they're more like communist Russia, for crying out loud.
Well, they're kleptocrats. I mean, they're stealing everything they can. And here's the thing. And Bill Clinton said this really well in Seattle when I emceed that event last Monday.
I wish I could have
with him.
That.
Yeah, that was a hoot. And he said, you have to understand that the conservative worldview believes that the greatness of a country is measured by the quality, by the number of extremely wealthy people and the power of its most powerful institutions. And traditional Americans, and traditional, you know, liberals, but traditional Americans have always believed that the greatness of a country is measured by the quality of the life of the middle class of America.
Right.
And so if you're a conservative and you believe that the power of the greatest and most powerful institutions is the greatness of America, then it makes perfect sense that you do crony capitalism. You'd give, you know, all these no bid contracts to your buddies at Halliburton, and you'd try to enrich the rich, and you'd have tax cuts for the most wealthy and all this kind of thing, because it's consistent with their philosophy. The guys aren't thieves. They actually have, I mean, they may be behaving like thieves, but they actually have a consistent philosophy. It's, in my opinion, a wrong philosophy, but it's not a new one. I mean, it's a philosophy that Alexander Hamilton and John Adams were arguing for back, you know, during the Constitutional Convention. So it's just a wrong one. Thomas, thanks for the call.
Oh, no problem. One other question or one other statement I'd like to make.
Yeah.
And that's on this Katrina thing. I have friends that have went down there. And they've tried to, you know, they're supposedly going to be paid for working down there.
Yeah.
And they was down there for 2 and 3 months and never got paid a dime.
Hmm.
And they're not spending this money that's supposedly allocated for Katrina. They're not spending it. Halliburton's the only ones getting anything out of it.
Yeah. Well,
as far as I can tell.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Thomas, if you get any documentation on your friend's experience, pass it along to us, would you?
I sure will.
Sounds like it would make a good segment on the radio.
Yeah, sounds
I appreciate
great.
It. Okay, thanks for calling in. Mm-hmm. Catherine in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Catherine, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
We have maybe a minute or so left. We're just up against the top of the hour here.
Oh, no, that's the way it goes. I want to ask if you had ever read the book Asking Is Given?
No.
By Esther and Terry Hicks. It's about the the focus of your attention on, let's see a second, on getting what you want is what we need, and that would be, you're making me nervous because I can't believe I have so much time. The power of the law of attraction.
Mm-hmm.
What you think is what you get, and that's what I'm saying. It's all Democrats. We got to start thinking we're going to get it because we're not losing again.
Yeah, there you go. We need to be moving in a powerful and positive direction. Thank you very much for that point. And here's really how it works. Human beings have basically two motivation strategies. We're either trying to avoid pain or we're moving toward pleasure. And trying to avoid pain will motivate a lot of people very, very quickly. It's like, you know, yelling at a kid or something like that. You know, whoa, what? You know, it's like, or touching a hot stove. I mean, that, but over time what it does, it's like whipping a horse too often. Over time, it exhausts it and it falls over dead. On the other hand, if you are moving toward pleasure, If you're holding something out as a positive vision, that moving toward pleasure, it doesn't have the immediate motivational power. So it doesn't scare people like Bush saying, they're going to hit us unless you vote for me. It doesn't have that immediate motivational power. But it does have the inspirational power of helping to build the kind of country that we want. And we really, I think it's so important that we hold a positive vision of what this country can be and what this country has been in the past, the good parts of what this country has been in the past, and keep moving in that direction. And speaking of that, up next, right after the news, one of the most heated Senate campaigns in the country, Ned Lamont will be joining us just one day before Connecticut's Democratic Party primary, where he leads Joe Lieberman by double digits. Be right back. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Ned Lamont is with us today, down to the wire day. Tomorrow's the election in Connecticut. Ned Lamont taking on Joe Lieberman. Ned Lamont, welcome to the program.
Tom, delighted to be here.
Great to have you back here with us. NedLamont.com, the website, by the way. It's been quite a few months since we've spoken. And you are, according to the mainstream media reports, pulling ahead in the polls here. Does that cause you, Ned, to be pleased? Or does that worry you that people might say, he's ahead in the polls, I'm not going to show up?
Let's put it this way. I was in the New London emergency room at 5 o'clock this morning, greeting a lot of folks who work really hard during a night shift and often are unappreciated. From there, I was at Electric Boat at 7 o'clock this morning, greeting a lot of guys who are working their tails off, building submarines, worried about their jobs in the future. So we're going flat out between now and Election Day, just urging everybody to vote and telling them how important this race is.
Taking absolutely nothing for granted.
Take nothing for granted.
NedLamont.com is the website, by the way. You can volunteer. You can help out. I'm assuming that you're going to be needing volunteers tomorrow to help get people to the polling places.
I am. We've got 10 offices around the state. I'm going to a number of those offices this afternoon. We've got thousands of volunteers who are all over the state right now, knocking on doors, putting out door hangers, just reminding people how important the vote is.
Great. Great. Ned Lamont, over the weekend I saw a so-called proxy debate between two Democrats, I'm sure you watched it, about you and Joe Lieberman. It was essentially, let's have a debate between Ned Lamont and Joe Lieberman without either one of them being here. And one of the things that concerned me was that one of the people, I think it was the guy representing you, I might have been wrong, said that you and Joe Lieberman agreed on about 80% of things. My understanding was that you're really far more progressive on most issues, that this really isn't just about the war. Did I miss something?
Yeah, I don't know what show you're watching, but Senator Lieberman and I disagree on the big issues of the day.
Let's go through
with the war in Iraq, what our priorities are, where we're spending our money, how we treat the rest of the world. It goes to energy bill and ecology and the environment. Joe was the only Democratic senator from New England to support Dick Cheney's energy bill, which provides billions of dollars of taxpayer subsidies to ExxonMobil and the oil industry. I thought that was a bad bill. We should have had fuel economy standards and conservation and dealt with energy independence and the environment in a serious way. I disagree with Joe for being too close to the president on issues like affirmative action and Social Security. I think it's there that you want the Democrats to stand up and say no privatization of Social Security. We're going to fight to protect this program.
Even though Connecticut, you've got a lot of financial services companies there. It's got to be. I noticed, Joe Biden, rolled over on the bankruptcy bill, presumably because he's got so many credit card companies in his state. It's frankly, I thought it was a tragedy. You're willing to stand up to those powers?
Look, I'm not taking any lobbyist money. We're fueled by 15,000 small donors, and we're going to take on any power that they to fight for the working people in this country. Yeah, the bankruptcy bill was a bad bill.
I mean, most of the people file for bankruptcy, you know, we read, or it's due to a health or a death in the family. It's
more than
unavoidable.
Yeah, more than 50% of bankruptcies in the United States are the consequence of somebody getting sick, and 70% of those people are insured, and they still get wiped out.
That's the number one question I get around the state of Connecticut, Tom. It's related to jobs and related to health care. People are still working 40, 50 hours a week, and they're earning less, and they're paying more and more for their health insurance, so they can't afford it at all.
Yeah.
The number of people uninsured is going up and up. And that's what they told me at the emergency room this morning. They said, my God, we're the primary doc for more and more people. They come in here at the last moment when they're sick because they have nowhere else to go.
So Ned Lamont, nedlamont.com, L-A-M-O-N-T.com. Ned, what would you do about that if you were elected to the United States Senate?
We're going to make a universal health care a basic right for all Americans.
Just basically Medicare for all?
Pardon?
Medicare for all?
Yeah. I mean, my plan is that we start by making employers that provide health insurance for their employees and let employers buy into Medicare so they can provide Medicare for their employees as a low-cost way for employers to provide a good package of health insurance for their employees. Absolutely.
Now, back in the 40s and 50s, when unions and employers got together and really first started offering health benefits, the major reason why employers went along with that is because they wanted the same employee to stay on the job for 20, 30 years. You know, that's also why they were offering pensions, to encourage longevity. Encouraging longevity doesn't seem like a real high priority these days any longer in the marketplace. I mean, there are dynamics that we could talk about that need to be changed, you know, our international trade policies and things, but nonetheless, that's kind of where it's at. So why have an employer-based healthcare system at all? Why not do what most other countries, most other industrialized countries do, and just have a single-payer healthcare system, a Medicare for all, that's funded by, you know, both corporate and personal taxes, where, you know, it's just there?
Well, we may end up there, but right now I want to make sure that we have a universal healthcare system that insures each and every person. And, you know, close to two-thirds of people are already insured through their employer-based system. So I'm going to start with the system we've got.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is right now is more and more employers are walking away from their obligation to provide health insurance for their employees. You know, right up here in this state, we've got large employers like Walmart that are just making insurance unaffordable for their employees.
Right.
I think that's a good start. I think it's something we can do on a practical basis. We can get that done in the near term. And I can just add that, you know, I'm a small business guy. We provide, obviously, health insurance for our employees. And when we lose bids, you're losing bids to fly-by-night operations that don't even offer health insurance. So let's level the playing field and make sure employers don't have an incentive not to insure.
So how do we do that, Ned Lamont?
You require it. You say, look, as a condition of work, you're obligated to provide a basic level of health insurance for your employees.
Mm-hmm.
And you allow small businesses for whom the health insurance can be a really crushing burden and too expensive, let them buy into Medicare. Let them buy into the congressional program. So that would reduce the cost, and then with some subsidies, we can make that affordable for all businesses so they can do it.
Right. Does it concern you, or is this a national perception that actually isn't happening in Connecticut, that you're viewed or at least characterized, particularly in the media, as a one-issue candidate, that being Iraq? Or do the folks in Connecticut get it, that there are a whole lot of other differences between you and Joe Lieberman?
The folks in Connecticut get it. You and I just talked about health insurance. We talked about jobs. We talked about Dick Cheney's energy bill. People know that there's a variety of reasons that we ought to have a real change in Washington. I'll leave you with one other one. There's a real distress up here about just how we're doing business in Washington, D.C.
Hmm.
You know, the fact that there are over 50 lobbyists for each and every congressman, spending over $400,000 a month per congressman in lobbying fees. And there's a sense that this is the best government money can buy. And I think they want people to go down to Washington who aren't tied to the special interests and go down and fight for working people, and that's what I'll do.
Yeah, it's good. And with regard to our trade policies, Ned Lamont?
We've lost almost half of our manufacturing jobs in the state in the last 18 years alone since Senator Lieberman was elected. And, you know, some of that is due to trade policies. We're the largest market on the face of this earth, and we ought to negotiate from a position of strength and make sure those agreements with China and others are reciprocal and fair and give our guys a fair work and a fair shot.
Why have trade agreements at all? Why not go back to the tariff-based system that served this country very well for 200 years?
Well, I think right now, you know, free trade in many markets has been beneficial for our economy, but it's some markets really has really been harmful for us. You know, I look at China as an example. So I'd like to think that we can make sure that we have an agreement with China that allows both countries to benefit. But right now, we're not benefiting. And the other reason we're not benefiting, Tom, is because of, currencies. The Chinese keep their currency artificially low, which makes their exports artificially cheap, and that doesn't allow our manufacturers to compete.
Right, but even if they doubled their currency, it wouldn't have that much effect. I mean, it would take some radical, drastic. I mean, we used to have a policy where we said, listen, if there's a dollar's worth of labor in a pair of shoes made in Connecticut, and you want to make those shoes in Malaysia for 10 cents worth of labor, that's fine, you can do that. But you're going to pay a 90 cent tax when you import them into the United States, called a tariff. And not only was that important to America, 100% of the federal government was financed by tariffs up until the Civil War, 2/3 of the government up until World War I, and 1/3 of the federal government up until World War II. I mean, this was a major source of revenue. Plus, it kept all of our manufacturing here. Why not reconsider it?
Well, we have an awful lot of companies here in Connecticut, Tom, and around the country that do an awful lot of export business. So I'm not interested in getting into a tariff war, but I am interested in fair trade. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And right now, I think a lot of the agreements we have aren't reciprocal.
Yeah, well, and I realize that to talk about tariffs right now for a politician is a pretty radioactive thing in all probability, so I probably shouldn't go there with you. But I appreciate the many positions that you're taking on a whole variety of issues here, Ned Lamont, and I hope people will go to your website, Ned Lamont, LAMONT, .com, and check it out, see how they can help you out.
And
good
if
luck
any
tomorrow.
Of you have friends in Connecticut, please tell them to vote.
There you go. And we have listeners. The Sirius Satellite Radio is covering the state of Connecticut as well. So, Ned, thanks a lot.
Great talking to you, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program where reason is our lifestyle choice.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
You have to wait for the opposite red hot speed and some really high grade hats.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The IWW, the Wobblies, is this Doug Cunningham with Workers Independent News, LaborRadio.org. Doug, is this the Wobblies that Starbucks has gone after?
Yeah, this is the Wobblies.
Wow! I mean, this is, wasn't Joe Hill with the Wobblies?
That's right, yeah. Don't mourn, organize.
I beg your pardon?
Don't mourn, organize.
That's right.
Joe Hill slogan.
Yeah,
that's right. And they fired a union organizer for IWW in New York City that's been active for the last couple of years trying to organize Starbucks stores there. A guy by the name of Daniel Gross. They fired him over the weekend. And
that's amazing. Let me just for nostalgia's sake, okay, here's what's her name?
Joe Hill last night, alive as you or me.
Joan Baez.
Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, said he.
That's the Joe Hill we're talking about, and the Wobblies. And Starbucks has gone after the Wobblies? I don't get it. Starbucks, you know, I think most people think of Starbucks as a pretty reasonable employer. They offer health insurance to their employees.
Well, that's what Daniel Gross was telling me this morning when I talked to him about this. He said they have this reputation as a socially responsible company. He says that's a joke. He says in New York City, for example, they were paid $7.75 an hour. They also get tips on top of that, but Daniel claims that that's only good for another couple of bucks an hour or so on average. So what's happened is in 6 New York City stores, Daniel Gross and some other activists, who also, there are other people fired, by the way. There are 3 others who are connected with the IWW that are fired, and IWW says it's because of union activity. There was an NLRB decision in March that told Starbucks not to take any anti-union actions that are illegal. They had to reinstate somebody then. And there are new NLRB charges now in these latest firings. But these activists are trying to approach individual stores at Starbucks to improve the conditions for workers. And Daniel and the others say that they're being met by a vicious anti-union campaign by Starbucks.
Remarkable. Daniel Gross, the IWW organizer.
There's a website I wanted to get in real quick.
Sure.
It's called StarbucksUnion.org.
Okay.
And that's where the IWW is focusing its efforts to try to get these employees reinstated and to try to get traction with their organizing campaign.
And I'm assuming there's a link to that off laborradio.org, your website, Doug Cunningham?
I'm not sure if there's a link there or not, but if not, people can remember both, I think. StarbucksUnion.org, laborradio.org.
We're talking with Doug Cunningham. He does the Labor Radio news at some of our stations here at the bottom of the hour on this program. And Labor Radio news, it's, you know, the thing that amazes me, Doug, is I remember growing up in a country many more years ago than I care to admit, where newspapers, I grew up in Michigan, and there was the Detroit News and the Detroit Free Press, and one of the Detroit News was, as I recall, was the Republican paper. I might have them backwards, but one,
no, that's right. That's
yeah,
right.
It was the Republican paper, and it had the business section in it, and the Detroit Free Press was the labor paper, and it had the labor section in it. There was the Democratic paper, and you knew that there was a certain, you know, selection bias of news, but at least you knew what the bias was. Now they're all owned by giant multinational corporations with tentacles into defense industries and whatnot, and they're all producing the same homogenized news, and none of them are talking about what's happening with labor. What, for example, this is the first time I've heard a story about the Wobblies in forever. I mean, you know, what's going on? What is the state of labor right now? What is, and what's going on with the Wobblies?
Well, I mean, the Wobblies have been around for a long time. They're small. I mean, they're very small.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to give anybody the impression that there's this gigantic, you know, Wobbly movement out there. But they've done some innovative things at Starbucks, and they're still active in the movement. And they are some of the most pure in terms of being labor activists and really believing in the cause with a passion and really pursuing it.
Well, they were one of the first.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And you know, their idea was one big union, right, to get everybody involved in one big union, and working class would then rise together. And that's what they're about. The labor movement in general, of course, is split now between the Change to Win Federation and the AFL-CIO, but there's a lot more money and effort being put into organizing by both those camps these days.
Do you think that split, you know, I spoke at the ILC, the International Labor Communications Association annual thing, the AFL-CIO convention,
right? Yeah,
a year ago, Amy Goodman and I were the two speakers,
mm-hmm.
And the belief at that point was that the split was actually going to ultimately be a good thing for labor. I mean, you know, nobody really wanted to say it out loud, but I think there was a kind of consensus over the. Here we are, a year or 2 years later down the road. How's it worked out?
Well, we've talked to both of those camps about how it looks 1 year later, and Stuart Acuff, the organizing director for the AFL-CIO, said that in his estimation there's no doubt that the split actually has hurt labor. At the same time, he says the AFL-CIO has been more robust than in many, many years with its organizing this year.
Hmm.
On the Change to Win side, Greg Tarpinian, the executive director there, says that he thinks that the new federation has made great strides and that they have been able to implement some of the agenda that they have, and he thinks it's a good thing that they are out there doing that on their own. So,
yeah.
Again, you know,
so the verdict is still out.
Right. And and I think there's a little mixture of both in there. Both things are true. It's hurt the labor movement in some ways, but in other ways it's reinvigorating it in some others.
Yeah. I suspect you're right. Doug Cunningham, Workers Independent News. You can get the all the labor news over at laborradio.org. Doug, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Great speaking with you. It's 27 minutes past the hour on the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And it's gone, gone, going, gone, everything gone, give a damn. Gone be the birds when they don't want to sing. Gone people, how awkward with their things gone.
And welcome back, 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Telling the truth that the multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know all about. Welcome back. By the way, we have a comment line if you'd like to leave your thoughts on the program. For those of you who don't like to call in live, you can call in and leave a recorded comment that we can then play on the air. The number is 503-323-6620. Give us your take in 30 seconds or less, 503-323-6620. Remember, your thoughts and opinions may just make it on the air, so make it count, 503-323-6620. Following up on this, last week we had Professor Juan Cole a professor of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Michigan, on, who was talking about how a year ago there was an Israeli general traveling around the United States doing a PowerPoint presentation about the invasion of Lebanon, suggesting that perhaps the current hostilities were not entirely unexpected, shall we say, and which provoked this caller.
So when Juan Cole says that Israel and the United States plan this war, what does that mean? That Israel and the United States got Hezbollah to attack, or they have some spy pretending to be Hezbollah do the attack? What kind of stupid propaganda do you have on and not even ask that question? You are the most naive, gullible idiot I've heard in a long time, and there's plenty of them. And I am never listening to you again, you f***ing head.
So there you go. You got a variety of opinions, see, on the phone there. Here's another one.
The Democrats are going to lose this year, and the reason why is that as long as they keep control of the voting machines, as long as we keep electronic voting in, they're going to win each time because they have total control over those voting machines.
Yeah, this is a concern as well. First of all, no, I don't think that the Israelis were involved in any kind of weird conspiracy. And in answer to the first caller, and in answer to the second one, yeah. And my concern with the electronic voting machines goes beyond just the electronic voting machines. It's the fact that they've privatized the vote. I mean, you start out with the idea of the commons. That's the foundational idea on which this country was founded. Prior to the creation of the United States of America in the 1770s. Arguably prior to the Declaration of Independence. Prior to that point in 1776, every form of government, with the single exception of a couple of hundred years of an experiment in Athens, Greece, other than that, every, in quote, Western form of government, civilized form of government, in quotes, including the Asian ones and the South American ones that the Europeans didn't know about, all of them operated on the assumption that all the common land was owned by the royalty. You couldn't hunt in the king's forest without the king's permission. That it was either the warlords or the theocrats, if the church owned it, or it was the feudal lords, the rich. One of those three. They owned everything. And what we did in the United States when we created this country was we flipped that upside down and we said, no, there's this thing called the commons that we all collectively own. Our school system, our police departments, our fire departments, our air, our rivers, our national parks, our government itself was part of the commons. It wasn't owned by the warlord kings and queens. It wasn't owned by the church. It wasn't owned by the rich. Those being what Thomas Jefferson referred to as the three classic forms of tyranny, the three historic forms of governance that for 7,000 years governed the world. One of those three forms. And they owned the commons. Well, no, we flipped that upside down and we said, no, we the people own the commons. And to administer those commons, we elect representatives to represent us in government, which is part of the commons. And we tell them, you know, hey, by electing you, we want you to do what you said you're going to do. Administer the commons for us. So you could argue that the most important of the commons is the vote, because it's the means by which we choose the elected representatives who are administering all the rest of the commons, from the military to the schools to the roads to the stop signs to everything, all those things that affect our lives and the quality of our lives. And somewhere along the line during the Reagan years, the vote got privatized. You had Chuck Hagel, who was the president of what is now ES&S Voting Machine Company out in Nebraska, selling his voting machines to Nebraska, and then when the whole state buys them, he decides to run for election after having worked for 20 years for George Bush Sr. before he went out to run the voting machine company. And as the Washington Post says, the upset victory of the year. Even African-American neighborhoods that had never before voted Republican voted for this guy. What a surprise on a vote counted on his voting machines. Now, I've got serious problems about the integrity of voting machines, but my bigger problem, and this is the issue that nobody's talking about, that we all should be talking about, is that the voting machines are owned not by us, but by private corporations. What in goodness name have we done where we have created a situation where the most vital of our commons is no longer part of our commons, it's been privatized? privatizing the vote is a felony against democracy. There's no other way to describe it. You say, well, there were voting machines before that, and starting in the 1964 election, the Goldwater election, Goldwater-Johnson. It was the first election where we had the lever machines. Yes, but those machines were owned by government. And they were programmed by government to the extent that you could open the little panel on the side and see where the little wheels were. So if we must have machines, they, in my opinion, you know, it's okay if Diebold makes the machine, but have the machine be owned by government, be maintained by government, and have the software be open source that's available to all of us so the entire process is once again transparent. Because that's what democracy is all about. And this is the problem I have with Rush Holt's bill, the legislation that's out there that seeks to solve this problem. It doesn't do anything about the privatization of the vote. It says, well, let's make sure that the vote has integrity. Let's make sure that everybody has a voter-verified paper ballot. I'm sorry, it's not enough. I want the corporations out of my vote. You know, if George W. Bush has some private corporation, you know, has Halliburton serving food to guys in the mess hall in Iraq, technically that's a violation of the commons. I mean, it's the military. It shouldn't have been privatized. Or if he's going to privatize the concession stands at Yellowstone, technically, you know, those are small crimes against democracy. Those are misdemeanor crimes against democracy. But privatizing the vote, that's a felony. That's a felony. Anyhow, enough of that rant. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Matt in Sacramento, California, listening on KSAC. Hey, Matt, what's on your mind?
One quick thing. What happened before you do the Iraq things? You have that song in the shadows, the man in the shadows.
Yeah. When I do our updates,
who sings that?
Jackson Browne.
That's Jackson Browne.
That's Jackson Browne. Yeah, it's called Lives in the Balance. If you go to jacksonbrowne.com,
I've got to buy that CD. Anyway,
there's a video actually on his website that goes with it. That's just a jaw dropper. I used to have a link to it on the top of my homepage. I should probably put it back up because it was just so cool. But yeah, it's Jackson Browne.
That's an awesome song. Anyway, I've got a question. If poor countries like Mexico can do regular paper ballots and sit around and count them, why can't we go back to that? I've been in places in Nebraska where they sat there in the schoolrooms and counted the ballots.
Yeah.
The people counted the ballots.
Well, this is what Bernie Sanders is calling for. It's what I'm calling for. Let's go back to paper. Canada tried machines, and they said we don't need – this isn't working. They gave the machines back. They gave them back to the American companies.
Right.
And said,
just dump that.
If we can print paper
ballots like Mexico.
Right. Every other country in the world uses paper
ballots. Well, if we don't start asking for the root problem, we're not going to get anywhere. We've got to go back to asking for something real simple people can understand.
I agree. Matt, thank you very much. It's a good point that you make. And in fact, saying, you know, the paper ballot, and then we'd save billions of dollars. Because you have civil servants take a couple of days off their job at the DMV or whatever and count ballots with volunteers from the political parties watching. The way it used to work. This isn't rocket science. The way it's done in every other country in the world. In Germany, I lived in Germany for a year. In Germany, the vote is entirely on paper. It takes them a day or two to count the ballots. But they know within 10 minutes of the time that the polls close who won the election. Why? Because they have exit polls. And those exit polls, since the 1950s, when they first started them, when the German Republic actually started, you know, got up and got on its feet again, those exit polls have never been more than 0.1% off. And the exit polls in the United States, prior to the 2000 election, were never more than 0.1% off. And then all of a sudden, the 2000 election poll showed that Al Gore easily beat George W. Bush. And we had to say, well, oops. And 2002, the exit polls in Georgia, for example, were showing Max Cleland, you know, clearly beat his opponent. Max Cleland, who lost three limbs in Vietnam. But instead, Saxby Chambliss, the Republican, according to the voting machines, which didn't have a paper trail, he's the guy who's in the Senate now. And then they did follow-up polls after the election, and sure enough, still, even in the follow-up polls, Max Cleland, 4 or 5 points ahead among people who said they voted. I mean, we've got a badly broken system. It is just a plain old badly, badly broken system, and we need to do something about it. And we need to do something about it straight away. And as so many callers have said, just a very simple thing. Let's just throw out the machines. Go back to paper. Good old-fashioned paper. It works. You know, and you get civil servants in there to count the stuff and have the political observers, and we can do this. This is not rocket. This is how they do it in France. It's how they do it in Germany. It's how they do it in England. It's how they do it in Israel. It's how they do it. It was good enough for the Iraqis. It should be good enough for us, right? That's a start. Anyhow, back with your calls and more in our Iraq update. Right after the news, or right after this break, rather. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's coming through a hole in the air. Nads in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the fields that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Oh, from your lips to God's ears, Leonard. Democracy coming to the United States, spoken by a good Canadian. Welcome back, 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy in America. Let's take a quick look, before we go to your calls, at what's going on with the U.S. ongoing occupation of Iraq.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lives in the balance. There are people on the fire. There are children as a cannon. And there is blood on the rise.
Near Khalis, these are the security developments in Iraq from Reuters. As of 09:30 GMT, Monday, August 7, near Khalis, four civilians were killed and seven others critically wounded when their minibus was struck by a roadside bomb. In Baghdad, a bomb and a car bomb exploded in quick succession near the commercial building on Palestine Street, northeast Baghdad, wounding three people. In Balad Ruz, at least six soldiers were killed and 15 wounded when gunmen opened fire at dawn on an Iraqi army checkpoint near that town. In Khan Bani Saad, a bomb targeting a police foot patrol exploded in a vegetable market in that town. In Fallujah, six civilians were killed and two wounded when a roadside bomb targeting a police patrol exploded in the center of that town. And in Baghdad, two people were killed and 18 wounded when U.S. and Iraqi forces raided a suspected death squad in the mostly Shia area of Sadr City. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Gerald in Brookings, Oregon, KBBR. Hey, Gerald, what's up?
Oh, the name's Joe.
Joe! Hey, Joe.
Oh, yeah. Just to remind people that the Aaron Russo movie, America from Freedom and Fascism, is playing in select cities right now. They can check that out at www.freedomtofascism.com. But, yeah, to talk about the fact that, why is it that Bob Ney gets to drop out of the race in Ohio and the Republicans get to replace him on the ballot, but the absolute opposite is going on with Tom DeLay in Texas?
No, that's a good question. I don't know the answer, but that's a good question. You raise a good one, Joe. Good on you. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff. Yeah, there we go.
Yeah,
hey,
here.
Jeff. What's up?
Well, when you mentioned the voting machine vendors, it's interesting that past few years I've been going to lots of meetings on voting and so forth. The Secretary of State here in Colorado, you got the blue ribbon panel, the voting machine vendors are there. I wrote a letter to City Council recently. It went to the voting machine vendors within a couple hours after I wrote it.
Wow.
I won a local test for voting machines. They're the vendors. Then county clerk recently in one local county was called out to show off the voting machines. The vendors went along. And they're always there. And
yeah.
What's interesting is when she's showing the machines, she's starting this electronic machine up, and it didn't start up. She goes, oh, this never happens. Of course, we have reports to the contrary.
Mm-hmm.
But the most bizarre thing is somebody asked her, actually her opponent in the election for county clerk, asked her, what about the central tabulator? How do you secure that? She said, oh, we don't have a central tabulator. The county clerk did not know about the central tabulators. which Whoa. Is one of the central components of any voting system.
And, in fact, it's the machine that Howard Dean hacked on national television on a topic he gave with Tina Brown. I mean, that's the thing. If you really want to, if you really want to make a Republican cross-eyed, point out to them the fact that the only politician who has ever hacked a Diebold machine live on national television in less than 90 seconds and reversed, untraceably reversed the outcome of an election was Howard Dean.
Yeah,
and he did it on Topic A with Tina Brown, and to, just to prove that it could be done. And, you know, it's like, I don't get it, why this is a partisan issue, why all the Democrats are saying we need to get rid of these voting machines or we need to reform the system, and all the Republicans are going, oh, no, we like everything just the way it is. And then you say, oh, but did you know that Howard Dean knows how to hack a voting machine? And they go, what?
And here's a county clerk of a major county in Colorado did not even know there was a central tabulator.
Incredible.
She's the one most responsible for, you know, the votes.
Incredible.
But given that we, you know, we've had such a hard time determining really what's happening with voting problems, I've got a new website coming up today, later on. It's called reportvotingproblems.com.
Good one.
And what that is, it's a central database, hopefully to be international, as right now it's national.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody who has a voting problem, you can go to this site and report any problem from registration to absentee ballot things to problems with machines. And we're hoping to create the first real central repository of information about voting problems.
Great, great. Now, and the other big, and thanks, Jeff, for the call. The other big scam, this is happening in Oregon right now. I believe it's in Oregon. I've got the story around here someplace. Anyway, these folks are now saying, would you like to sign a petition to decriminalize medical marijuana? And when people sign it, what they're actually doing is they're re-registering as Republicans so that they can no longer vote in the Democratic primaries. Bizarre. No, it's actually happening. They've been outed. Rick in Erie, Pennsylvania. Hey, Rick, we've got about 30 seconds before we've got to wrap the show up. What's on your mind?
Yes, sir. I like your guest, Peter Walston.
Yeah.
And first thing, did I hear you right? $1.5 billion to the second largest health company CEO?
Yes, it was front page of the Wall Street Journal about 2 months ago. I did the better part of a 40-minute rant about it on this program.
Okay.
He had $1.5 billion in 1 year's compensation. This is the company that is now the largest provider under Section D Medicare of Medicare benefits.
Okay, maybe I'll let it go there. I hear the music coming up.
Yeah, okay.
Thank
Rick,
you.
Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. And thanks for listening on WPTT there in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Much appreciated. Tomorrow, I'll be debunking conservative Douglas Murray on his new book, Neoconservatism, Why We Need It. Yeah, right. Thomas Mueller's dropping by, The Drive to Drill the Arctic Refuge. It's got nothing to do with energy independence. That and more. I'll be doing the show live from the studios of Air America Radio, New York City, tomorrow, by the way. So we'll see you there then, assuming that flights go well and technology actually works. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.